Every successful person got there by going through tough times. Success is a hard-ass teacher who likes to knock you around along that journey. You know, it takes real guts to not give up and keep going. We'll hear stories about failures and how these leaders flipped the script to create success. I'm John Schultz. Join me and let's discover how success is never really overnight. So welcome to the John Schultz podcast. We're very excited today. We have an amazing guest, Kathy Vidal. What a story. Everyone's going to be very excited to listen to this podcast. Kathy's Undersecretary of Commerce for Intellectual Property and Director of the United States Patent and Trademark Office. She leads one of the largest intellectual property offices in the world with more than 13,000 employees. I can't even imagine that. And an annual budget of $4 billion. The principal IP advisor to the president and the administration through the Secretary of Commerce. Vice Chair of the Council of Inclusive Innovation and formerly a managing partner of Winston & Strawn and former global head of litigation at Fish & Richardson. IP everywhere, all over your career, and you're still going, but in a different way now, and that's what we're going to learn today. So thank you so much for being on. We really appreciate it.
Well, and thank you for having me on, John. I'm a big fan of your podcast, and I was so thrilled when Kara Golden connected us. So really looking forward to today.
Terrific. All right. So, I say this because I want to get my guests ready for what they have to talk about. And, you know, it's the myth of overnight success. And I feel when we're younger, you know, there's so much about us that it's so interesting. So my first question is, like, what did you want to be as a kid growing up? Like, what was your, you know, younger years and what did that look like?
So I appreciate that question. So I will say there were three areas that really interested me. So I was always interested in science. My parents don't know this. I don't even think my brother knows, but I used to always experiment with different chemicals in the house. It may not have been the smartest thing to be doing when I was a very young child, but I always thought maybe I could make something better. So, and then in addition to that, I remember at one point asking my mom, I think I was about seven, and I asked my mom to take me to the library because I at that point, I also was interested in being a pro baseball player or a lawyer. So I thought at that point that if I started reading cases as a seven-year-old, I would know all the case law by the time I was a grown-up. So obviously not realizing at that time that they are making case law every day, but those are some of the areas that just really excited me.
Wow. How does a seven-year-old even think to read a case law? Like that's unbelievable. I guess it's how you grow up and who you grow up around. You know, my family was in real estate. So, you know, I was always hearing about buildings when I was younger. And I always say this, you know, most people are driving down the street and they're looking at candy stores or where am I going to get my next toy? And I was looking at buildings. So I totally get that. And science, I guess it came easy to you, or you know, you just kept going with it and through school, and then what happened to like sort of embrace that in college? How did that go?
So I will say it was something that was always a passion of mine. I don't know if it came easy or not. It was more something that I was always interested in and always exploring. So when I, you know, even when I was in high school, I remember going to a garage sale and seeing an oscilloscope. And you know, realizing, wow, now I can look at electronic waveforms. Like, how amazing is that? So I bought it, I think, for $10 and experimented with that. I will say that you know, when I ended up going into a scientific field, I was interested in everything. It wasn't because that was the one thing that really drove me. I was better at more of the right brain things than I was at left brain science, math, those kind of things. But I was good at all of them. And I just was encouraged at that point by guidance counselors who said, look, you're a woman who's excelling in these areas. It would be really great if you were to focus in that direction. So that's, I started focusing more in the high school range. I will say I grew up on military bases around the world. So I was able to take all my science classes early. So in ninth grade, when they said, what classes do you want to take? I signed up for everything science. So I took, you know, instead of taking biology 1 year, physics 1 year, chemistry 1 year, I took them all early. And then when I was in high school and my guidance counselor was pushing me in that direction, I decided, well, I want to start that now. So I left high school and went to college at 16 and started out as a mathematical physics major.
Wow. So very driven. Oh my God, right? Not many people make those life decisions so early. And it was science. So I know you started reading the case studies, you know, because you were interested, but science and law don't blend. So how did you end up making the transition, I guess, from science to law, and what pushed you to do that? Because it really is, I mean, it's a much different path.
It is. And I will say that, you know, I thought about law early on, you know, like I said, when I was about 7. I think that was mostly influenced by the TV shows that were on at the time and seeing how that could be used to help other people. And then, you know, I was certainly interested in law in high school as well. I remember taking a history class. And once I got onto law, I asked if I could get extra credit if I went and summarized cases. So I would go to the library and summarize case law. But it wasn't something, you know, once I went into engineering, I wasn't focused on law anymore. I always want to do the best I can and dig as deep as I can in whatever I'm working on. And because law didn't intersect with what I was doing, I really focused on engineering for many years until I got to the point where I had my bachelor's in electrical engineering. I had my master's in electrical engineering. I had graduated from the Edison engineering program, which was a program at GE Aerospace or GE generally. And at that point, I was thinking, what's next? And I realized that in the scientific field, companies really benefit when you go deep and you have a lot of experience that you can apply. And I like learning new things. I, you know, at a point where I've got, you know, 80, 90% proficiency, I want to move on. I want to do something different. And what the law afforded me was the ability to continue to use my scientific background, but work on different cases and learn all kinds of different technologies.
So it wasn't like sitting there on one problem, right, for a very long period of time. You got to learn, you know, all different problems and use a different skill to solve it in a different way, which I find that's sort of how I am too. I love learning new things every day. And you said you grew up in a military family and you had to move a lot. So what were the challenges of that? But also looking back, what did that make you do and be in maybe a more proficient way? You know, one thing I was thinking while you were saying is like maybe because you kept moving, you really threw yourself into work. And, you know, 16 is an early age to do what you did. Maybe that was one of the reasons. I don't know. What's your thoughts?
I would say a couple things. I think moving generally, there were two things that I did, one of which I don't think was as positive, but it helped me learn more about myself. My parents would always say that about 3 months before we would move, I would break off all my friendships so I wouldn't be hurt when we went to the next Wow. location. So I thought that was interesting because it wasn't something that I recognized I was doing. I was very young when I was doing it, and it was just more of a self-defense mechanism. So it was good to learn that I was doing that and realize that that I want to live my life in a different way. I will say one of the things that I think was a benefit was just continually being submerged in a new place, new roles, and having to make friends quickly, having to redefine yourself, and because you kind of get a clean slate every time you go somewhere new. Yeah. And so I think that was, it really gave me the ability to be thrown into anything and dissect it, try and understand the rules, try and acclimate pretty quickly. I'll also say that because I was in the military or in a military family, my parents were going through their education process at night. So I was exposed to them going through college, them getting their master's. And I just remember even when I was in seventh or eighth grade, I thought, well, I can do those courses. Like, can I just go to college now? I mean, just having that exposure and not having college seem like something completely separate and apart from the things that I was already competent to do, I think just changed my mindset to really look at opportunity and push the boundaries in terms of trying to get those opportunities sooner rather than later.
And so it's interesting. So you didn't even realize you were not cutting them off, but you were sort of moving yourself on and being able to compartmentalize, I guess. And I know in business, for me, there's always ups and downs every day. It's never the way we think it's going to go. You know, we're really not in control of much. So to learn how to actually have that skill at a young age, I happen to have to learn it older, which I wish I would have learned it when I was younger. Is that's an interesting way to look at that. So, okay, so you went through that. You know, obviously law was your thing. What was your first job that, you know, you think had the biggest or jobs that had the biggest impact on you, you know, moving forward, you know?
So it's interesting. If I go back to, my first job, besides, you know, babysitting, or I used to make cakes for the Navy for events, because my mom did that. And I thought, again, oh, I could do that. So I got a job doing that for the Navy. And then I had a summer job working for the military where I just did random tasks. I think the first job that really struck me was, and it's interesting, it was working at McDonald's. And being told that because I was a woman, I couldn't work the kitchen and that there are certain jobs that I could do. And, you know, this was in college where I didn't have money. I needed a quick job to get some money. And, you know, I think that just started kind of reshaping the way I looked at the world. Like I didn't really, before then, I didn't really see any impediments. I didn't realize that people thought about things in that way. And realizing that I'm not going to be in environments like that. And I need to make sure that the environments that I'm contributing to really are supportive of everyone.
Wow. I love that. Listen, it just shows like along the way, our experiences are what makes us, right? And you could take them in a positive way or you could take them in a negative way. So what do you think was the most eye-opening experience professionally as you were moving forward? I know, you know, at GE or, you know, you had some really cool jobs that you were in. What would you say is the most eye-opening for you?
So I'll give you a positive and then I'll give you, because I love that you focus on, you know, mistakes people make. And I didn't think that's how we learn. So yep. I will say, first I'll start with a positive and then I'll go through, you know, an experience I had that was not positive at the time. So okay. On the positive side, I feel like I always leaned in to try and do things more than what people have expected of me. So when I went to my first law firm, I just had come from a clerkship, so I was only a second year lawyer. And usually offices had hiring partners that did all the hiring. Yeah. And I looked at our practices and our inability to attract certain people. And so I asked if I could play that role. And I actually talked to one of my colleagues who was the same year as me, and the two of us were given that position. So we were essentially hiring partners as second year lawyers. And then, you know, even when I took my first leadership in a law firm, I saw ways that I could contribute and I expressed that. And so I was managing partner of over half of a major law firm as a junior partner, which is something that's, you know, relatively unheard of. And so I think it's the, you know, the kind of the aha moment with all that is just realizing your own potential and how you can contribute and finding a way that's authentic to you to convey that so that you can get those opportunities. I will say on the flip side of things, when I was an engineer, I remember I interviewed at the company and I did not. So it was me and then four men that looked like the person who is the hiring person. And when we went through the interviews, I got asked all these questions on what's inside an A to D converter. I mean, things that I had not learned that afterwards I found out I gave good answers, but you know, how do you detect a hurricane if you're in the air in an airplane? Really rigorous questions. And then I remember going to dinner that night and talking to the other four guys saying, gosh, what wasn't that a rough interview? And they said, oh, no. He took us to lunch. He led us toward the lab. He didn't ask us anything. And I ended up a couple years later being assigned, because it was a rotating program, I was assigned to that same unit. So that same person ended up becoming my boss. And I remember that, you know, I wanted to keep my head low. I just wanted to kind of get through it, not make any mistakes, not prove that maybe I was, because he also suggested they not hire me. And luckily, right, other people thought that they should hire me. So I avoided the conflict of it. And so, and then when I got my review, which was at about a time when the company was about to do layoffs, I did not get a good review. And it just made me realize that I had to own that, right? Like initially your reaction is, this is not fair. I'm doing a good job. You know, there's issues here. And it made me realize, like, I have to own other people's perceptions of me. And the best thing for me to have done was to lean into the conflict as opposed to doing conflict avoidance. So that was a really good lesson for me to learn early on. I won't say that I always applied that lesson over time, but it really made me realize that the objective truth of what you're doing is not as important as how people perceive it. That's really what has impact.
And I love that, because like you can avoid things forever and never get to a point. I also think we all have blind spots that we don't even realize we have. And unless you lean in and have sometimes and not in a negative way, in an empathetic way, right? Like, you know, if you make it where it's really not about you, I think you can get through those situations in a much more pragmatic and successful way. So to you, I guess obviously you leaned in. So like, how did you lean in, and then how did it end up going from there?
So I leaned in by really, I mean, it was hard to have the conversation when you're told you're not doing well, when you think you're doing everything great, you're usually applauded for what you do. So I had some follow-up discussions and said, look, I want to take what you said to heart. I don't remember what the critique was at the time. I just remember the feeling of, I can't just get the review, go to my office, and then, you know, keep working as usual. I really have to figure out, what is it I can be doing better? You know, what could I have done differently to have received a different review? And so I leaned in that direction. It was great at the end. I had a decent relationship with the person. You know, it was limited in some ways, but I just feel like that was positive, because then I went on from there to other units and then ended up getting into leadership before I went to law school. And there was no reason to burn bridges or to feel personally offended by what had happened. It was just more important that I use that as a learning experience and grow from it.
Would you say that's one of the things that defined you as a leader today, on how you lead?
It does define me. And I will say, it gives me hope in everyone. So there have been times when I've been asked to fire people within my group. And I always say, look, first, we have to give them the feedback. I want to make sure they get a coach. I believe strongly in that it's not enough to give feedback. We need to make sure that somebody owns that. And sometimes as a leader, I don't have the time to help them own it. So I often brought on coaches and that would have them own it, have them come up with their own corrective action plan. And some of those people are in amazing leadership roles in law firms across the country right now. And so that's how it influenced, you know, how I lead, is I believe that even if somebody gets a bad review or makes a mistake, that's an opportunity for them to learn and for them to grow and to, you know, and my thought is, I want to see the full potential in everyone.
Yeah, no, I love that. That's terrific. So I know you did this Edison engineering program at GE, and, you know, Jack Welch to me was a legend. I mean, I followed him my whole life. He gave me inspiration. Why? Because I felt like he was such a network effect person, but also he was so into the minutiae and training part. So what do you think you got out of completing that program, and what do you think was your aha moment on maybe what you know, pushed you forward in your career?
I would say there were two aha moments through that. One was, as part of the program, the first year we had to go through an exercise with no real answer and had to work beyond our jobs to solve some electrical or other issue and come up with a solution, write an entire paper, work on a team, and do a presentation. And that really just taught me how to quickly assess a situation, get in, understand the dynamics, figure it out, and come up with a solution. So doing that 36 weeks in a row, you know, really impacted the way I look at rolling up my sleeves quickly, diving deeply, and, you know, not delaying, just doing that with all haste. The other thing that the Jack Welch leadership taught me was just how to make decisions. You know, I know that one thing I always loved that he said is, we're going to be number one or number two, or we're going to get out of the business. And so I thought, that's a really good way to communicate clearly what your vision is. It's a really good way to look at things, that if I can't be, you know, even as on a personal level, if I can't be the best at what I'm doing, maybe it's not where I should be. Like maybe there's a different use of my time. And, you know, not just for a job, but just even different tasks that I'm working on. If I feel like, and that's how I've made a lot of my decisions, if I can't have impact, whether it's as a board member, whether it's speaking at an event, if I can't have impact in what I'm doing, then I'm not going to do it. Like there's no, right. I'm not contributing anything.
Yeah. Listen, that's a good way to be. I think all of us really want to feel that. And I always say, like, impact can be at any job, taking a process that, why do we do that? Like asking, like he was asking you to solve problems that almost you couldn't solve when, you know, if you apply that to just everyday business, there's all these little things that we can, and you just got to ask yourself the question, not be like, oh, we've been doing that way forever. Right. Which I think is how progress becomes exciting. So, all right. So you did Winston Strawn, you know, and then Fish and Richardson. And then obviously, you know, you were as high in someone's career as you could possibly be in IP and what you do. And then you get this call. You get this, I mean, like, So how does it feel to get a call to, you know, be in the position you are today? And, you know, how do you even go about thinking of whether or not you want to do it? And then, you know, I'd love to hear that.
So I will say, so my call came through an email, and I will say a year before I received that email, a couple different people just really lightly said, hey, if you were, I know this is not your area in particular, but if you were to be asked to be in this position, is that something that you would accept? And at that point, you know, they're talking, and this is not the White House. These are just people in the community. And at that point, there's, you know, who knows how many people that they're having those conversations with.
Right.
And so I thought, you know, even informally, I would never want to say something to somebody that wasn't true and that I wouldn't live up to. So I thought about it. I thought about the competition with China. I thought about the need for America to be more innovative, that a lot of companies are really beholden to quick ROIs for boards. You know, what more can we do as a company to, or as a country, to be more innovative, to solve world problems, to create more jobs, and to have more access to the innovation ecosystem so that it's not just the Silicon Valleys of the world that are innovating and the Research Triangle Parks. It's in every community. And so I thought about it in terms of, you know, could I make an impact? Could I help the country in that role? And so, and then I made sure, because I was on the West Coast and now I'm on the East Coast, that the family was going to be okay with that. So I did say, if offered it, I would accept. And I ran it by the chair of the firm too. I said, this is so speculative, but I'm not even going to say this if you have a problem with that.
Right.
He said, public service is number one. We will fully support you if you decide to go in that direction. So so I just lightly said, yes, if I was offered the position, I would take it. And then a year later, I just get an email from the White House that says, can we talk? And so then I thought, and at that point, it was all playing out in the news as to people who were being considered and where they were in the process to the extent that it was leaking. And so, and they hadn't picked somebody for quite a long time. And so I thought, well, maybe that's what it's about. So so I took that call, and, you know, it was interesting because I always approach things in the most authentic way I can. I told, and one of the thoughts is, if we did pick you, are you going to be able to get through Congress? Right. And I made it very clear that, you know, I thought it was a fair candidate. I think I represent, although I've represented big tech, I've also helped a number of inventors, a number of startups. I've invested in startups, including in Kara's company.
Yeah.
It's a very much a part of all that I do, but I did make it very clear that I'm not going to lobby for it. I said, I know a lot of people are lobbying. I know a lot of companies are trying to push people forward, and I do not want to feel beholden to anyone, because if I give up my career that I have and go serve in the government, I'm only serving the country. And I will hear from all stakeholders, but I don't want anybody to feel like they have more access to me or that I'm beholden to them in any way.
Wow. So, all right. So here you go. You're in. And how does that first day feel? I mean, because it's so big, right? How do you get your hands around it? And, you know, obviously we want to hear all the programs that are going on and what you're trying to push forward.
So I will say that because it takes a while to get confirmed, I did what I normally do. I just dug in on every issue that was facing the PTO. So a lot of what we do is we do requests for comments here at the PTO, and we solicit feedback from stakeholders on all the critical issues we're dealing with. So I went through and read all of those. I read position papers on things. I read, you know, people said what more the PTO could be doing. So I read proposed legislation. I just studied as much as I could, and I called as many people as I could, either in government right now to say, I'm the nominee, would love to understand how you're approaching this. And so by the time I got to day one, it just felt natural. It just felt like, okay, it's the next day of working on all these issues. And
yeah.
I remember even before I got there, I said, I want to have a town hall as soon as I get there. Like, I want people to know who I am. And the initial proposal was, we can do that a few weeks out. It's like, I want to do it like on the first day. Like, I want to do it the first day or two. Like, I want to engage immediately, because that's who I am. I'm somebody who wants to engage with everybody in the organization. I want to understand their thoughts. I want them to know who I am. I want to know who they are. So the first day was, at this point, I just feel like this is what I've been doing forever. It's hard to remember doing anything other than what I'm doing right now. And I've been here about 10 months now.
That's great. I'm thinking back to now, like, your whole story. Like, if you didn't start reading briefs at 7, I don't know if you could have gotten up there. Because think about how much you actually have to learn. I mean, it's daunting. I'm just me thinking about it. It feels daunting. But anyway, you were the right person at the right time, and that's always what usually happens. So what are the programs? You know, I know you started the WE program. What are the programs that you're trying to educate people on? What else should we know? What else would the listeners want to know about, you know, the patent office and how to understand what's the initiatives are?
Well, and I appreciate that, John. You had mentioned something a few minutes ago in one of your questions and comments about, you know, not just taking things as they've always been, right? Looking at things and trying to see if you can make improvements. So yeah. I will say that is something that we are doing across the entire agency on everything that we do. It's been phenomenal. We've transformed how we do hiring. We've brought in a DEIA consultant who's helping us shape job descriptions, opportunities, everything from that to how we examine patents, how we route patents to individual examiners, all the nerdy stuff within the organization. Yep. In terms of your audience, what I would say is know that we're doing everything to make the system work for everyone. They are welcome to comment because everything we do is going to, you know, that's formalized is going to go through a public comment period. So if they care about anything from what's patent eligible to the way we conduct ourselves, we invite that engagement. But bigger picture, a lot of what we're doing really focuses around equity and access. And it's equity and access, not just for equity and access sake, but also because that's what we need to grow our country. If we can quadruple the number of patents, we can grow our economy by $1 trillion. It's also the case that when we don't patent, then we're basically offshoring all of our great ideas because they're being taken. They're being taken through espionage, they're being taken just if somebody publishes a paper and doesn't patent, they're being given away. And so to the extent that we've got competition with other countries where those countries have made it clear that they're competing against us and want to win races against us, I think it's critically important that anybody in the, you know, anybody who's a scientist or engineer or entrepreneur or building a company, that they think about how do they protect that and how do they work with us to make sure that we've got a better ecosystem, whether it's trademarks or patents or other forms of intellectual property. So what we're doing is through our Council for Inclusive Innovation, we are doing everything from making sure that children are educated on innovation and entrepreneurship. Last year, we educated 280,000 children in the U.S. on through Camp Invention, which is a collaboration with the National Inventors Hall of Fame. We educated teachers throughout the country on how to teach education. We're ramping that up. So I'm sending a letter to every superintendent in the country and asking them to bring Camp Invention into their schools, to bring innovation training into their schools. So everything from that to thinking about the way we interact with people when they engage with us, how do we meet them where they are? So I doubled down on free legal counsel for those who are under-resourced. As soon as I got in here, I knew that was a big opportunity. And I will say right now, the number of U.S. inventors on patents that are women is about, the percentage is about 12 to 13%. When we get out there and meet people where they are in their communities and give them access and give them free counsel, that number jumps to 43%.
It's amazing.
Yes.
It's almost like everyone's out there just waiting to be aware of how to do it, right? I mean, just like our hope, like just this, it's so important, and energy, because I think attention goes where energy flows, right? It just does, no matter what. So
I love that. I'm going to borrow that saying. So I love that. Attention goes where energy flows.
Listen, I borrowed it too. So
okay. I'm writing that one down. So you're absolutely right. And that's why recently the Secretary of Commerce, Gina Raimondo, and I launched WE, the Women's Entrepreneurship Initiative. And we're getting together with communities. We're having discussions on how do you get funding? How do you protect your intellectual property? How do you form mentor groups? And so we're looking to lift people, give them those networks and opportunities, the ones that we've had. You know, when you build a startup, like, you know that you've got to have people you can collaborate with and network with. And so we're trying to bring that to everyone in the country. And so all of our initiatives, outward looking, are focused on that.
That's great. You know, I'm involved in my local community on bringing arts and culture into the schools. And it's just, there's so many different ways to learn. It's just got to be there so you can feel it, you know, and experience it. And I love that. So how do people learn more about this on their own, right? Because obviously you're doing what you're doing, but Is there a website? Like, how do you actually do this in an effective way?
Well, I appreciate that. And I will say on art and culture, the Camp Invention teaches that too. And,
oh, it does.
And because of that, well, the art part, we're working on the culture part, including with indigenous tribes. We're trying to figure out how we incorporate that element. But it does teach art. And we found that by including art with the science, you get girls who will join for the art who are attracted to the science. You get boys who will join for the science who are attracted to the art part. So, and then it's, you know, it's the whole brain, right? It's the left brain, the right brain. And so it's a phenomenal program, and happy to share more about that. In terms of your question on how people can learn more, we just established a formal LinkedIn page for me where I'm blogging about everything that we're doing.
Oh,
so,
good.
So you can find it there. I will blog about anything important, upcoming opportunities. We also, if you go to USPTO.gov and look for the subscription center, or just put that in a, in a search tool, you'll find a way to sign up for our emails. And I will say, what we're trying to do is we're trying to take an all of government approach to this. So whatever you're doing, government is trying to help. So we're doing, you know, we're doing the WE initiative with women. And by the way, it's inclusive, not exclusive. Lots of men show up to it. It's wonderful. It's nothing that we do is exclusive. It's all, how do we shape it in a way that people feel included? We're going to be setting up some other channels on that. We're working across all of government. So, you know, with CHIPS, there's billions of dollars that are at play where if people are looking for jobs or how to get involved, if they want, if they're looking for funding, there's a lot of government funding for through EDA as well. So I will say, if you pay attention to the USPTO channel, if you follow my LinkedIn, I'll also blog about the other across government opportunities to get funding and to get that engagement. So I think that's probably the best way.
Well, listen, I'm excited just by listening to you. I want to go learn right now. Because it's so good when you see someone. It's just the energies. We're on a screen. It's coming out of the screen. I'm so excited to see where this all goes for you. I know there's a lot more you're going to get accomplished. And I just appreciate you coming on and educating us about your story. Because, like, this is what you're doing, but it's about the whole person and how that person is in the world, really, and how we move forward. So thank you for being on. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And thank you for telling all these stories. I think they're inspirational. I love hearing other ones, and hope people benefit from this one.
Thank you. Great conversation today with Kathy Vidal. If you like what you heard, please like, comment, and subscribe on all podcast platforms and YouTube. And I'd really appreciate a 5-star rating on Apple if so inclined. Thank you.